This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
That's weird.
Well, is everything okay?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Just weird. Okay.
There was a pause like it was like a technical issue or something again.
No, I was like doing math in my head. And so that always sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Record scratch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll all hold our breaths while you do the minuses and pluses.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anytime there's a pause, it's like, oop. She's doing her figures again.
She's working on her figures.
I think whichever animal has more of a human eye is the more meat version. So like pigs have closer human eyes.
Pigs are closer to people, so than cows. Yeah.
Cows just have straight up, animal eyes. And that's our podcast, everyone.
Definitely
we talk about how you have to earn your curse words. That's our thing in our house. It's like curse words are earned. And generally they're earned.
So what do you have to do for like one shit? Like what do I have to do?
You got to earn that, man. You can't just throw it out there.
Shoveling the walk or something? Or what do I have to do?
My kids will never do enough work to earn it. So it's easy.
Oh.
Never. Okay. So it's just easy to be like, well,
You're raising lazy but polite children.
Right. Listen, one out of two ain't bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
One out of two ain't bad. I'm doing my sums again.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter. And I'm a writer, bud. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Welcome, buttheads. I don't know why I just really emphasized the butt there, but I'm feeling the butt. With us is Dmitry Samarov, who paints and writes in Chicago. He's the author and illustrator of 6 books. He sends out a newsletter every Monday. An absurd amount of his work is collected at his website, dmitrysamarov.com, which is 17 years old now. Damn. Welcome, Dmitry. Yep.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome.
Thank you for being on.
All right.
What are you going to read?
Okay, so I'm going to read a short thing from a book that I'm about to send to the printers. Hopefully this week or next.
Who's publishing it?
Me.
All right.
Same guy who's published the last couple. And, it may be the last one. I don't know. We'll see.
You had one right?
Yeah, well, yeah, the tortoise was a sort of a collaboration thing.
Okay.
Cool. And,
I guess me and Alex are on the same label.
That's true. Yeah, yeah.
So cool, bro.
But that was the first book that I sort of made soup to nuts myself, like designed and found the printer and everything,
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I've been doing. This is now the fourth one, the one I'm about to send. Yeah, but it's the first that is being officially called fiction. Because it has to be, because I changed names and stuff. Because you have to protect the guilty and have plausible deniability and all that shit, But the book is called Old Style, and it's set in 2 bars in Chicago between 9/11 and the plague.
What bars?
One is real and one is a composite made up one.
Okay.
So I'll just read this. I'm not going to say the name of this chapter because it would kind of screw up well, you'll give away what it's about, but okay. I'll say the name afterwards. So here I go.
Yay.
Can I ask a weird question? Is this place haunted? She came in with a big wedding party. They're all near the back of the bar by the photo booth. Three tables pushed together, laughing, drinking, taking pictures. She wanders up to the bar by herself, steps out of sparkling high heels, leaving them on the floor by the ice machine, and plops down on a bar stool. She stares through the mirror, somewhere past the liquor bottles, storage room, to the empty lot past the long shuttered currency exchange. She twirls an unlit cigarette between her fingers while sipping at her drink. She asks about ghosts again. No, I say, I've never seen any. But this has been a bar for 100 years, so unsettled spirits wouldn't be out of place. I make a lame joke about the only spirits around here being trapped in bottles, which doesn't register with her at all. She says it's a 13-year-old boy and points at several spots around the room where she sees him. She begins to get upset that neither Eber, the doorman, nor I see what she sees. We reassure her that we're not mocking her. She asks my name and says hers is Elroy. I don't ask her if her parents named her after the writer of The Big Nowhere. She asks where I grew up, and when I tell her Boston, she gives me a knowing look. Honest answer, I used to be a sex worker in Vermont. I went to Waltham, Brockton, Burlington all the time. She tries repeatedly to maintain eye contact, gauging what effect her revelations are having. When I come back, she's guessed Eber's sign. She nods slowly and reveals that he has a troubled relationship with his grandmother. He plays along, wanting her to hear more about the 13-year-old ghost haunting our bar. Next time I return, she looks deep into my eyes and asks how I'm doing. When I say I'm doing fine, she doesn't believe me. Then she orders an old-fashioned. But don't make it too sweet. I want it extra bitter, with bullet rye. Then she asks Eber if he can score her some coke. She says we're disrespecting the ghost by not acknowledging it. What's the best shot? Okay, give me a whiskey. She takes a sip, then pushes it towards Eber and wanders outside to smoke. She wants another whiskey 15 minutes later, but I tell her the time for shots has passed. She badgers Eber about cocaine some more. Her fellow wedding revelers leave and she follows. Eber is disappointed when I tell him she was a prostitute. He thought when she said he was cute, she was being sincere. After I close the bar, I notice her sparkly heels still sitting on the floor by the ice machine. I leave a note for Lon about Cinderella leaving her slippers. Maybe she'll come back for them. In the meantime, her 13-year-old ghost can keep watch until they're safely back on her feet. So that's called Ghost Hooker. It's from old style, forthcoming from Pictures and Blather, which is what I call my press, which is just a thing for putting out my own books.
Awesome. I was going to ask you if she had a green ribbon tied around her neck. Because I was like, she is definitely a ghost.
Who knows which. What she was, but so like as I was saying before, I have to call this fiction, but I didn't have to make anything up that's in this book. There's some composite people, which was weird to do and I'd never done before, but I didn't have to make anything up.
What made you make them into composites? Like, what was that impulse?
Well, when I made up the bar, mm-hmm. So one bar is real, and both of the bars are bars I worked at mm-hmm. for real, you know, but one is closed and been reopened several times by other owners. So, and that's the one that was at just after 9/11, so, you know, mm-hmm. 20 years ago. And the one that's more in the present, is one that will, well, maybe will reopen. Who knows at this point, but it's based on a couple of other bars that I worked at. And to make some of the timelines fit, I guess. And because basically the big through line is everything, mostly everything that happens in this book happens within these bars, you know. There's some tangents, but everything's based around these places. So that's probably partly why I had to have composites. And then also because the episodes get repetitive, and you know, I, instead of having three different women, you know, dump me, I had one woman dump me, and, you know, like, you know what I mean?
Yes. So I ask because I'm so interested in these connections that you can kind of come upon as you're writing through something that you might not have seen before. And that might, you know, lend itself to being a composite or,
and some of it also is me thinking about the actual people that I'm writing about and how much do I want to anger them. So I have to take away some of their attributes and give them some other ones, you know.
I know.
Are these people that you know will read the work for sure?
Some of them probably will. It's an interesting thing. I mean, I knew I had to write this book just because that's been my sort of side hustle the last 5 years and on and off. It's always been a service industry for me, but I've been working in a bar the last, well, for 5 years until the shutdown, until last March. And then I'd worked at this other bar about 20 years ago, and I made a zine about it about 12, 13 years ago. And it kind of hung around my sort of consciousness as a thing that I thought might be elaborated upon. And that's, so it's come back.
So you've always had jobs talking to people. It sounds like, it seems like just always facing customers, always in conversation, the cab, the bars. Have you ever wanted to do something other than that, as far as like just kind of squirrel away at a desk or something, or do you really prefer being out with people?
I don't know that I prefer being out with people, but I've had these service industry jobs since I was a kid. You know, like I got my first job when I was like, I don't know, 14 or 15 in a bakery, and I've had these retail or service restaurant bar kind of jobs forever. And then, I mean, what I've done since I was a little kid was drawing and painting, and I knew that that's not any way to make a living in this society. So I knew I'd have to work somewhere. And I tried to go to grad school for painting, and I dropped out after one semester because I was just done with being in school. And I decided that I didn't want to be a teacher. And that's the only reason to be there. Unless you need motivation to make art, you know, because in painting, for a lot of people, like grad school is the last time they ever make their art because they have that supportive environment. And once they're out of the cocoon and nobody cares about what they're doing, they stop, you know?
That's true for writing too. I find that, you know, like if someone's not like, hey, you owe me some pages, or, hey, you know, like, let's talk about what you worked on, then that sort of falls away, right? Like they got their fill of it.
It's funny, yeah, because did both of you guys go to MFA programs or?
We did.
Okay.
I went to the Art Institute.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, just like you.
Yeah, I went for undergrad, though. Yeah, I didn't. I went only to undergrad. for painting. But I've never taken a writing class, and writing came into my life much later. So if I guess I qualify to be on this podcast, not because I don't have any kids and I'm no longer married, but I didn't start out being a writer. I've never taken a writing class.
You're a writer, but you've never taken a writing class. No. And I think that's more and more, I think that's, you know, there's like a big discussion happening. I think that's always going on about, do I need an MFA? I write, and it's important to me, and I'm making these books, but I don't have an MFA. So does that mean I'm not a writer? And it's absolutely, you are a writer, right? Like, there's no correct path.
No, definitely not.
I guess not, but it wasn't. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, you're fine. I was just saying, for a lot of these jobs now to teach, you need a PhD. I mean, it's like, it's crazy. It's all craziness.
Yeah. And those are all, but that, the academic whole thing, that's a whole other discussion. Those are completely artificial, made up barriers. You don't need any of those degrees at all.
Absolutely. So, I'm glad you brought up barriers because I want you to talk about the fact that you self-publish your stuff, that you make it yourself mm-hmm. and you hustle it yourself. Is that because of like feeling like you have to push up against those kinds of gatekeepers and barriers and stuff?
Well, one of the things that happened was, so I had a charmed experience with my first book, Hack, which came out in 2011. Mm-hmm. It came out from University of Chicago Press, and they came to me to publish a book.
It's amazing.
And I didn't, I mean, it was like, total Cinderella story. Because I had a blog and I had, I'd made these zines about being a cab driver, and somebody there heard about it and they pitched it, to their bosses, and it went through. And ever since then, it's just been like, one comeuppance after another, like it seems like backwards, like you're supposed to like go up from, I don't know. The second book came out from a press whose name I'm not going to say, but it was run by a crook. Mm. I was quoted in an article about it. I'm not like, it's not a secret, but right. Kind of like our former president saying the name is just free publicity, you know? Mm-hmm. I had that experience, and also dealing with, a place that was completely mismanaged, run by a couple of well-meaning people, like they did the actual work. But then like there was a book designer who didn't own a copy of InDesign. So he mashed all the text in my book. And it looked like a compound German word, and it took like four of us to disentangle it. So after that, I knew that I could fuck up my own book my own way, better than that.
Yeah.
So I knew at least at that point that I wanted to try designing it. But then, after the second book, there was a 5-year gap where I couldn't get anybody interested in anything I wrote, couldn't get an agent. I've never had an agent. Mm-hmm. None of that. Like it was just like totally howling into the void, up until sometime in 2018 when I pitched Jerry at Tortoise about this weird music book idea that I had, which is collecting 30 years of sketches I did of bands playing and like with connected kind of memories. Mm-hmm.
That's a beautiful book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So that's the first book I designed. I found the press. I did the whole thing, if you like that book, you'll like my books.
I mean, it really pops on the shelf. I remember seeing it. I can't remember if I was at Jerry's place picking something up or what it was, but I saw it and I was like, what is that? And it's just mm-hmm. beautiful.
Yeah. But going through that process sort of gave me the last push I needed to self-publish, because I always thought, like so many people do, that it's like it's a step down and it's sort of like a vanity thing and it's not real, to just self-publish. But at this point, and with the tiny press like Jerry's, it's right. not like he has this huge promotional reach where he can get things reviewed places or placed on bookshelves. And then there was the added issue of it being a hardcover book produced independently of his usual channels. So that book up until very recently wasn't available in any distribution system at all.
Oh, wow. Mm,
wow.
Yeah. So there's a lot of steep learning curves involved, but on the flip side, I figured out a very economical way to produce good looking books. If I'm willing to do all the work myself,
It sounds like it's similar to like it's art making, right? Like it's
bringing it back to a scale and a format that I understand. So my books are basically they're kind of like limited edition prints with some words in them,
mm-hmm.
because they all have art in them. And that's where I can't imagine making a book without art in it. It's what I come from, you know, mm-hmm. it's what I understand. So, yeah, it's a little bit different than, I guess, the average writer. My relationship to books.
Why do you think you pair words with your art?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, because I think in images, and I think my default way of, you know, self-expression or whatever, dealing with the world really is drawing and painting.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. it's always where it starts. It was much later that I realized that I could actually put words together. I was always a reader. I grew up in a family in like a house filled with books. My father is like the biggest reader I know, but I never, you know, I didn't take a writing class. I never went to college. I went to art school, you know.
What was that first impulse to think this goes with a story, or this goes with an essay or a piece of memoir?
It totally came out of driving a cab. So I drove a cab for 12 years. And the first go around was in Boston right after I graduated from the Art Institute. I moved back to Boston. And my first job out of art school was driving a cab, like a year after I'd only learned to drive. So,
oh my God.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my
goodness. I went, you know, zero. This is the way I do things. Yeah. There's kind of a no in between. and I spent 3 years in Boston driving a cab, then eventually moved back to Chicago. And around the year 2000 or so, like I kept having these stories eating at me, these things that happened in the cab. And I knew that I couldn't just do drawings about them. So I got a manual typewriter, a Smith Corona, which I still use for art. Like if you look at my website, all the text on it,
yes,
it's done with a Smith Corona, which is then scanned. And then I put hotspots in it for links and stuff. It's really, really tedious and old school the way I do everything. But
it looks like a zine. You know, like it's cool. Right.
So, but yeah, I originally got that typewriter to make a zine, which I called Hack. And it was mostly drawings, but with like a sentence or two on each page
mm-hmm.
about my 3 years driving a cab. And then a couple of years after that, I started driving a cab again in Chicago and revived Hack as a blog. And then it went from there.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's the difference between driving a cab in Boston and driving a cab in Chicago?
They're really different, but I was also kind of two different people. I mean, in Boston, I was, you know, from 23 to 26, 27. In Chicago, I was 33 to 42.
Right.
So I sort of had, I was in different parts of my life. But Chicago's was built for cars, whereas Boston's built for, you know, cows and horses. There's no straight streets. I spent half my time giving out of towners directions, you know. Mm. And it's also just a big overgrown college town. There's all these college kids there, so huge transient population, and like to play tricks on cab drivers. It's really annoying.
Oh god.
Yeah, like pile in like 9-10 kids, you know, and then give like a 50 cent tip, that kind
of
stuff.
Gosh.
It was obnoxious. Yeah, very different. So Boston, like all public transportation would stop at 1. So people that were out at bars would be stuck. So there was it was a pretty good way to make a living. Although, but on the flip side, Boston's much more expensive than Chicago. So, you know, really different. But also when I first drove in Boston was the very first time that like cell phones they were trying out cell phones, you know? Mm. And so I had a cell phone where I'd have this external antenna that I had to like put on top of my car.
Whoa.
Reception. It was a bag phone like that you would plug into the cigarette adapter for power. So, and I use it just for business, just for calls, you know? So there's that, like the technology developed so quickly afterwards, you know? And then, by the time I got started doing in Chicago was started to become ubiquitous. And then the year I quit, 2012, was the year that Uber came into
Chicago.
So that was the end.
technology.
I got out in time.
Yeah, really. You knew. New piece of technology that comes out, I always without fail think that's stupid. I'm never going to do that. And I thought that about iPods. I thought that about cell phones, Ubers. Sure. Just like, this is so dumb. Who needs these? And then I'm like, let me call an Uber from my cell phone.
Yep. I actually can't call an Uber because I quit smartphones about 6 years ago.
Oh, wow. Good for you, man.
I went backward. Like I made a stand. It was the same year that I quit social media. It was, I really think it saved my sanity because that was right around the time, the ramp up to the previous election.
Oh my God.
Ugh.
Yep. So I'm very thankful. For once I did the smart thing.
I always tell people, you'd be surprised like how easy it is to get off of these social media websites. Like I remember thinking how am I going to stay in touch with people if I don't have Facebook? Then just getting off of Facebook and being like, oh, I just don't go on Facebook anymore. It's fine. and the same thing.
Well,
with Twitter.
you do find out who your actual friends are. That's
right.
True.
Right.
and it's also just it's a lot of other people's psychological baggage that you're just lumping onto your own back and shoulders just by scrolling.
Oh, it's so stressful.
It is. It's this person's sad. Yeah. Oh, that person's funny. Oh no, that's sad. Oh, this is funny. And it's like,
and people get mad at you. Like, I was so thankful the minute I didn't have to like anything ever again follow anybody. Like, I don't have to follow or like anything.
Yep.
Except if I actually want to follow them or like them.
when I like you, I follow you.
Exactly. Sort of similar to getting into driving a cab after just learning how to drive. When I was on Twitter, I put 7 years in on Twitter. I was in the salt mines of Twitter full on, I'm the type of person that I'd get up and scroll through my timeline from when I was asleep. That's how compulsive I am about that stuff. Mm-hmm. That's why it has to be completely taken away. I can't manage it, or be casual about it. So
I hear that.
Just to turn it off.
There were nights when I would be up with the babies and I would scroll so much on Twitter that I would literally reach the end. There was nothing. And I would refresh and just hope and pray that someone was up at 2 a.m. and was going to tweet, and it's you just feel such an empty shell. Refresh.
You need to cultivate those friends in China and India and Australia, people in other zones.
You need to diversify your friend group internationally.
You never have to go to sleep. You could just keep refreshing forever. Right. Yeah,
exactly.
This is really good advice. And I thank you both for it.
Mm-hmm.
Dimitri, how would you want people to describe your art?
Oh boy. You can't pigeonhole me. mostly it's what I have been doing or was doing for most of my life is kind of drawing or painting from life, from direct observation. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of cityscapes or the rooms I live in or the people I know. Basically looking at things and trying to draw or paint them. That's
how you would want people to describe. This artist looks at things and tries to draw or paint them.
Yes.
Dimitri.
that's the movement of art that I belong to.
That's awesome.
It's honest, it's real.
Kind of similarly to when we were talking about how what fiction is or making things up. Like I don't make anything up. I don't think I have an imagination. I really subscribe to that whole school of thought that you're an artist or a writer is sort of a channel or, a conductor of things that come through them and your job is to kind of spit them back out, hopefully not too distorted,
But your art is so distinctive.
Editorialized. Okay. Well, maybe you could describe it better than me. Sometimes the artist is the worst person to ask, really.
I love it because it makes me very happy that you answered that way in sort of like a dead end, you know, like how could you ask me this way? Because that you're right. That's, I feel the same way if someone asks me about my stuff.
It's like, yeah. When some person that's never read anything asks you, what do you write?
Sure. Yeah, you'd just be like, I don't know. I even thinking about this, I just want to die.
Well, I mean, the unsaid thing too is the best part about, you know, any kind, you know, painting, drawing, whatever. You don't have to just, here it is. Here it is. It's right
here.
I
know. That's the beauty of it.
I love that. I mean, that's... yeah, you guys should go on Dimitri's website because he has tons of his work on his website. The cityscapes. Yeah,
ten trillion pieces
of
art.
It's all right there.
And the real butt heads know that we did post some of Dimitri's Silverstein portraits.
That's right.
Thanks for doing that.
Because he's a sex freak, in case you guys forgot.
That's right, but he didn't know that because he's not on social media. So
No, I asked his permission.
Yeah.
I'm a good girl.
No, I can I'll every now and again look up other people's things just for context and stuff. Like, I mean, you know, Twitter you can look at without being a member. Like Instagram, you can't. Facebook, you mostly can't, which is just fine. Facebook, you know, nobody should ever have anything to do with Facebook.
Skip.
Before coming on this show, I kind of wanted to see what you guys were. What the banter was, you know, sure. About. So I looked at the Twitter feed and stuff and saw what kind of jokes you like to tell and stuff.
Oh, I'm so God, sorry. I feel so red.
I just feel shame. I feel deep shame. But back to what you were saying, Dimitri, about, you know, like tapping into a channel or, you know, the way you think about your art. It's so funny because when I was looking at your website, the way that you have your art organized was so pleasing to me, and I think I would have been able to maybe guess that you were going to describe it in this way. Just the fact that it's like there's such a matter of fact presentation where it's like, okay, here's the rooms, here's the cityscapes, here's book. I mean, just the fact that it's like you didn't dress it up at all. It's like, if this is what you want to look at, here it is. And and there's also seems to be like an inherent promise in that, like, and there's going to be more of this. It's like, I don't know, I love that about it. Just there was a kind of direct, no nonsense approach.
I mean the thing with, you know, visual art, with drawings, paintings, whatever, is you don't want too many words or explanations around them, because either that means that they're not working, they're not doing what they're supposed to do, or what the artist says will so color or influence the way you see it that you won't actually be looking at it anymore, you know what I mean?
Totally. Dimitri, I think what you mean is show, don't tell.
Yes.
Which, if you had been in writing class,
yeah, if I'd gotten a fucking,
you would have heard 800,000 times
seminar or whatever. What do you call the support groups?
Who knows?
What are they called?
It's all the same.
Workshops.
Yeah. Works. Yes, that's the word.
Support groups.
Support groups.
If only.
Works.
Yeah. I didn't do any of that stuff and came to sort of publishing and writing later in life, I've definitely been on a crash course of like reading and listening to all the podcasts and reading all the articles, because I'm sort of fascinated by the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Even the writing programs, but all of it. But I completely feel either out of my depth or disconnected from it. The only time I really feel connected with it for a minute or two is when, you know, I review books as part of the way I make my living. And then like for that brief second, publishers are interested in, you know, I'm important to them for about 2 minutes until they extract the blurb for their paper, the paperback edition of their book, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fun game to play. Actually, I've done enough of them that I've found them where I'm Chicago Tribune or Chicago Reader on the back of some books.
Oh my goodness.
That's awesome.
The nicer ones actually put your name on, but a lot of them don't.
Oh, you can change your name, right?
To Chicago.
My name
Tribune.
Is Chicago Tribune. Yeah, sure. Sometimes I go by Chicago Reader.
No. So you're asking, Lindsay, before about like the whole self-publishing racket, what's been your experience with, like, you know, you were at a major publishing house.
Yeah.
Was that, well, would you say lucky. net positive or?
You know what? I feel very lucky because when I published with Featherproof, I was great friends with Zach and Jonathan, and mainly Zach and I worked on it together. And so it felt like we were making it together. And when I moved to FSG, I was and am friends with my editor, Emily Bell, who's actually just left FSG for Zando. And so it also felt like something that I was like working on with someone that I trusted and loved and who I felt, you know, loved me as well. And, but it's, you know, it's definitely different, like going from an indie to a bigger house. I mean, like they're more of a, you know, like an old school traditional, like, PR type of thing. Like it's kind of hard for them. If you don't live in New York, they don't really, you know, like they're kind of befuddled. Yeah. Whereas I feel like the smaller presses are like, let's make a tour, you know, like let's hook you up with these writers in these cities and let's, you know, like there's a lot more like nimbleness, I think. But in terms of like the actual making of the book, I just felt super lucky in both instances because I had someone I trusted. Yeah. But trying to make new books and get through the gatekeepers, that's a mind fuck. You know,
right. Like, it's weird how, you'd think that you have a track record and you would get some kind of, you know, cred or whatever. And then you find out you don't.
Yeah. Because like, if your book doesn't, you know, like if you get an advance and your book doesn't make the advance back, then that's a death sentence. And it happens so freaking often to people. So that can be, and I've had those thoughts myself, like, well, I just want to make something. Like, why am I waiting around? I just want to make something. And I think that's my impulse for, like why I force Alex and I to read in every episode, because I just want to keep making.
Well, what would get you to jump through that or like do that? Like how many, like would it take like X number of rejections to just put out a book?
That's a good question. I've asked myself the same thing. I think part of it is like, I actually don't have time to make my own book right now, but I hopefully will one day. I was talking to someone and they said, as a joke, they were like, about someone else self-publishing on Amazon. And I was like, but that's legit. Like self-publishing on Amazon is actually pretty great.
Also, I mean, quality wise, as far as like most books, even the big houses now have gone to this print on demand model.
Right.
A lot of them are doing it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these books look like garbage, no matter what's the size of the press, you know?
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I mean, what I'm doing is sort of like a weird hybrid mix of things because I'm going to a printer and ordering, my books are in runs of 750. Mm. Because that's the smallest run they'll do for the kind of book I want, which is with the hardcover and stuff and this foil stamping, like these doodads and stuff that I need.
Oh, well.
You know, making it all fancy and shit. But it's surprisingly affordable. But yeah, you do have to come up with a sum of money up front.
Yeah.
But the trade-off is that per unit, per book, it's much, much cheaper. Like to order a bunch of books in advance. Yeah.
Is it a Chicago printer, Dimitri?
No, it's a Michigan printer. It's a printer named McNaughton and Gunn. They're really cool. They're near Ann Arbor.
Love Ann Arbor.
But they deal with a lot of indie print. They print a lot of stuff. I know they've done some Featherproof stuff. I know they also worked for the press where my second book came out, and that press still owes them money.
Oh, wow.
Because they owe everybody money and they stole from people. And
I think we all, like everyone listening knows what press you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You can make it a contest on Twitter. Yeah. And, let's donate. I'll donate a book to your favorite charity. If you know.
There you go, guys. You heard it here first.
Yeah. there is a way to do this if you adjust your expectations and play a longer game. Like, I have a house, like I have a lot of boxes of books in my house right now. Mm-hmm. but I'm also not, I don't need to sell them all right away. And I have faith that I'll eventually get rid of all of them. The music book is almost gone. It took longer because of the shutdown and some other things, but yeah, but if you do a lot of this stuff yourself, the costs are not exorbitant, you know, and you're splitting whatever you make with far fewer people. That's also another big factor, you know.
That's cool. And yeah, it also probably feels good to be making those aesthetic decisions yourself, especially as an artist, right? Like,
yeah,
not having to compromise on that.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, like with the first book, you know, I mean, University of Chicago Press is not a fly-by-night operation. They do a great job. And mm-hmm. I mean, dealing with them was sort of my grad school because I'd never been really edited before. I went through, you know, it's where I learned how to put together a book. And they had, you know, very, very professional people that had been at it their whole life. And I made some connections through that. Like to this day, the copy editor on that book is copy editing old style for
that's
me.
Awesome. Wow.
And I'm trading artwork with her. Like that's what we do. I barter wow. artwork for copy editing services. Awesome. It's not like I just slap a bunch of words into a Word document and then send it off to the printers. I do have actual like professionals go over it.
Yeah, I never would have accused you of that.
This is not 50 Shades of Grey 4 or whatever.
Oh, if only, right?
Yeah,
oh, I know. We could start our own press with all that money.
That's what isn't that funny that like yeah, all the like quote unquote real writers sneer at, you know, self-publishing. Meanwhile, there's this woman that is more successful than any 5 million of them will ever be, you know.
And it was writing, like Twilight fanfic.
Mm-hmm. Slash fic. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, totally. It's just unbelievable.
Sex fantasy, you know, fiction. Yeah. That's all it was.
That's the ticket.
That is the ticket. I can write a dirty book.
We know.
Well, thank you so much, Dimitri.
Yeah.
If people want to stalk you and follow you and like you, they should just go to your website.
They can go to my website. And they can subscribe to my newsletter, which that was a thing. So when I quit social media, like I'd already been doing a sporadic newsletter, mm-hmm. but then I poured all my soapbox energies into this newsletter, which I've been doing every Monday for almost 6 years now. Six years. But late last year, I switched it from Tiny Letter to Substack. Which I'm reading all this shit about Substack where like it's supposed to mean something and people sneer at that or whatever, but it allows people to sign up and pay basically. You don't have to, but like, so, you know, I've got like 350 subscribers, but like 40 of them have decided to pay me money, which is nice.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. So I do that. That's at samarov.substack.com. And, cool. The free one comes out every Monday, and if you pay, you get another one or two more a week.
Awesome. Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah, that should so do much. It.
And we're excited for Old Style to come out.
Yeah,
hopefully in April. We'll see.
Let us know. We'll hype it.
Yeah, I will. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Dimitri.
That was great.
It was fun. Yeah, it was totally fun. His stuff is unreal.
I know. I couldn't believe when he's like, I don't know. I just like make things as they look.
It's also like got such an, it like the stuff that is, it just really feels like Chicago. Like it's like.
Yes.
Really, really, really Chicago shit.
The light in them and the shadow and everything.
Oh my God. The cityscapes dinginess. Especially just like kill me. Like with, and a lot of them have like McDonald's arches on the horizon. Yes. Like, I fucking love it.
Oh, he's got a bunch of self-portraits as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
I always love
like,
that.
Across the board, the stuff is like really great.
Why? Whenever I visit somebody's, I should have asked him this. Mm. I want to buy your stuff. How do I buy? How do I click add to cart?
For sale. There's a for sale, Lindsay. Do you see like where it says cities?
You just blew it up. I see. I do see.
Oh shit, the old style cover is sick. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my god.
Do a portrait of Wanda.
Totally could. The book he did with Tortoise, I was not bullshitting him. Like, it really is beautiful.
Of course. I don't doubt that. I feel like I've seen it.
Because it doesn't look like anything they've done. I mean, for one, like you said, hardback, and it has like that letterpress thing. But do you remember when McSweeney's was doing books like this? Like, there were like a bunch of John Brandon books.
I was just going to say John Brandon. Yeah,
totally. Yes. Totally. Right. Exactly. And so, I mean, it looks that nice. Like, they're of like this Dimitri book is of the same quality for sure.
It sounds like that's what he's doing with old style as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go Dimitri.
Yeah. Very cool.
And now I'm just going through all his cityscapes. They're so good.
Me too. I know. I was just scrolling as he was talking. It's just like,
and it is amazing. Like, if you want to know what it's like to live in Chicago.
Yeah, totally.
Look at these bad boys. What if you find your own house?
That would be surprising. Okay.
How was your week?
Good. I think. Yeah. Good. I don't know. Mm, mm, mm. Okay. So the storm that happened today.
Right.
Obviously, that's like, are you huge, you know, effects work big time because mm-hmm. it's like, you
I was
know.
Thinking about you as I shoveled because I was feeling sorry for myself. And then I was like, oh, I bet it was hell at Alex's work.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, just busy, you know. And so, yeah, it was insane. And then they canceled the trucks for today as a preemptive move, which was really smart because it makes our lives easier. But so, yeah, you know, work was kind of intense this week. Today, I shoveled at 4 different places. Today was all about shoveling. But Britt and I got to spend some time together doing that. So that was our romantic date. That was fun.
Oh, well, well, well.
I know.
Early Valentine's Day.
That's like 2 Valentine's days worth of activity for mm-hmm. sure. But yeah, it was okay. It was an okay week, I guess. I'm reading a book that I am currently in love with, so that's been fun. I'm reading True Grit for the first time.
Oh my gosh. Oh, I haven't read it either, but I have like first edition in my nightstand that I need to.
Yeah, like Portis is one of those people, like when Old Open came out, several people who read it were like, oh, you would love Charles Portis. You would love Charles Portis. And I was like, okay, whatever. And because when people recommend things to me, usually I'm like, I don't care, whatever. Not that I don't care, but
that's
just
so
like,
you.
I'm just stubborn about it. I'm an asshole. And so finally I'm reading it now. And it's just like, you would fucking love it, by the way. It's so good. It's amazing.
Yeah. Ben has told me that before too, that I would love.
Oh, is Charles Ben a big Portis fan?
Yes.
Oh, nice. Awesome.
It's actually his copy of the book. And it's been in my nightstand forever. And I'm always like, oh, I should start that one. And then I never do it.
Nice.
But maybe now I will.
Yeah. How about your week?
It was pretty good. I got some work done. I got the manuscript that I'm working on right now over 50,000 words. So that was like
that's right. I saw that. Yeah.
Like, ooh, a little milestone there. But I'm like, I'm really starting to think about how I want to edit. I started like the editing process, even though it's not technically like complete.
How are you approaching it?
I'm actually like, I've never done this before, but I'm using a spreadsheet. Which cool. Like, I think if someone had suggested I do that, I'd be like, hell no. Like,
right.
what are you saying? Mm-hmm. But it's the only way I can kind of like, this is the like the kind of novel that I kind of need to see everything at the same time, which is impossible. And mm-hmm. I know some people use like colored post-its, but that has never really made sense for what I'm working
on. Yeah. That doesn't make sense to me for some reason. Like I think it's cool. Oh, it looks amazing. Are you okay?
But so I started that process and like I've always just edited my novels like just by kind of going back through them and like mm-hmm. reading them again and right. you know, but this feels like a different kind of structure and a different kind of project, so I'm kind of letting it like show me what it needs.
When you say spreadsheet, can you what do you mean by that?
I'm actually using a Google Excel spreadsheet, a Google, what is it? I guess it's called a Google spreadsheet.
But in what way? How is it like?
So each, you know, there's like, it's broken up into sections. And so I'm like saying whose perspective it is in that section. And then sometimes, like, I think I mentioned this before, sometimes Jackie is first person and sometimes she's third person. And so I'm noting that because I don't know if that's going to stay or if it's important. And then like what's happening and then like potential issues. And then I'm also trying to track like what we know of the murder because we get different details of it from, but you know, from different perspectives. And so I want to make sure that those make sense. I don't know. So that's how it started. But I know like as I was like typing up potential issues, I know that that's going to be like I might stop doing that because it's leading me down a path that I don't necessarily want to go down. I actually want to make sure that I keep thinking of Olive Kittredge. Have you read Olive Kittredge?
No.
It's a novel, but it's a novel in stories, and Olive Kittredge is either like a main character in each chapter or she's like someone like sees her as their own story is unfolding. And so I keep thinking like, oh, it's Olive Kittredge, but it's about a murder. And so I want these sections to feel like as complete as a story, because that's how those chapters feel. And it gives those characters like such a depth and such like a poignance. So that's the main thing that I want to keep track of as I'm going.
I love that. It's I've never used that approach, like some kind of system to map out, you know, details or point of view switches or anything, but I completely understand the concept of needing to have the whole book in front of you or to have it all in your head, because there is a point, even if you're just using that approach that you described that you use with past books, where you're just going back through and reading and reading and reading, you do reach a point where you have it all in your head. And like, sometimes it slips. It's like very ephemeral. You'll have it for a few days and then you'll kind of go back in and you're like, I don't understand what I was doing here. And you'll kind of have to read for a few pages to see what exactly the complete connection was, something like that. But that really is like a magical feeling as you're editing to have everything in your head, because it's really hard to get there with a novel.
It is. It really is. And I remember when the novel that's out on submission right now, when my agent was like, how did you do this? what were you, can you tell me how you did this? And I was like, I don't know.
Right.
But there was a moment when I did know, you know,
yeah,
and it's like,
absolutely.
I could get there again. I could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you want to read?
I don't have anything. I don't have anything to read.
I actually don't want to read either.
Okay, great. Bye.
We release you, buttheads.
Next week, we're going to have quadruple reading. So, you know.
Yeah. So hold on to your butts.
Hold on to your butts.
Hold on to your butts, buttheads.
I'm a Writer Butt is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Because there's a pandemic out there, please wear a mask. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop.
I'm totally going to do stuff like that when my kids are out of my house.
Totally. Just like
I'm going to like
weird ass routines.
Like Parker's going to be like, Towns, mom. Like,
I cannot even tell you what mom's doing.
It's so weird. Listen to what mom did. And Ben's going to be like, yeah, you know, your mom, she worked hard all her life. I don't know why he has a voice like that. All of a sudden, he's right behind me. That's how he talks when he's old. Oh, well, you know, your mom. It's funny to say it and then look at him. Anyway.